Dorothy Healy, the chairman of the Communist Party for Southern California. She's about 45 years old, about 5 feet tall. She weighs about 110 pounds. She is very attractive. She has a very vivid manner. And her life has now reached a crisis. And I'd like to find out how it happened. Where were you born?
I was born in Denver, Colorado.
Describe your childhood.
Well, we moved to California when I was six, my mother says, to avoid the chilblains that I was suffering from Colorado. My father was a traveling salesman, but the kind that liked his family with him. As a result, we moved around a great deal during my childhood, from Los Angeles to Long Beach to Oakland to Berkeley, back again to Los Angeles, back again up north. I once counted up the total number of schools I went to. I think it came to 16. Otherwise, I would say the childhood was a normal childhood, usual.
Were you an only child?
No, I have a brother and two sisters.
What sort of interest did you have in these school years?
I would say very typically, typical of most children, I played a great deal and I read a great deal.
And what kind of a student were you in school?
Well, those subjects which I liked, I was a very good student in, and those subjects which bored me, I was a horrible student in.
How did you finally graduate? With honors or not?
No, as a matter of fact, although I went to the 12th grade in high school, I left high school about 2 weeks before graduation to go to work in a cannery some 100 miles away from where I was living.
And that was your first major job?
That was my first job.
Mm-hmm. What did that lead to?
Well, I had gone to the cannery to go to work there because the canneries at that point, this was in 1931, were not organized. The conditions of the workers were pretty horrible, and I thought that maybe I could help in organizing the workers. As a matter of fact, while I was working in the cannery, we did organize into a union, and a strike took place about 2 months after I went to work. Several thousand cannery workers asking for a nickel increase, 5 cents per hour increase. This actually became my introduction to the life of a union organizer, which I then did.
And how old were you then?
I was 16.
And you were already in politics or in the union activity at that
yes,
time?
Yes, I was.
Why so early?
Well, I had actually gotten into politics earlier. I joined political organizations in 1928 when I was 14. I had first been stirred up to the question of politics. I would say the first question was the question of reading. I was very much stirred, deeply impressed by the writings of Mark Twain, of Thoreau, of Emerson, of Walt Whitman, Jack London, and I would think probably most influential in my life as a writer was Upton Sinclair. And my whole feeling at that point was a great indignation against the injustice that I saw being perpetrated on my fellow man that was so graphically described, most particularly by Jack London and Mark Twain and Upton Sinclair. I wanted to do something about what I had read and what I saw going on in my own society.
When did you get married?
I got married when I was 16.
And did this go along with the politics?
Well, it wasn't any contradiction to it. My husband shared my political views and was in agreement with my activities as a union organizer.
What kind of a man was he?
A very gentle man, a very kind person, an intelligent man, a good man.
Was he big and husky?
Yes, he was a very tall man. He was about 6 feet one, very slender man. And as I say, the biggest memory I have of him is a very good and kind and decent human being.
Did you have children?
No, we had no children.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you went into this union activity, what were your expectations?
Well, I was an organizer of cannery and agricultural workers. Most of my time was spent with the migratory agricultural workers. My expectation was centered around one thing, the desire to organize the section of our society which is the most oppressed, the most discriminated, the most exploited. And the organization of a union among migratory workers and cannery workers seemed to me to be the number one demand that was present in California to have any guarantees of decent living for these people.
What did your activity consist of?
Well, after the strike in San Jose, I traveled around mainly in the Imperial Valley and Orange County and later in Kern County, helping to set up unions for the agricultural workers, the migratory workers. The biggest episode of that period was in the Imperial Valley strike of 1934. The agricultural workers there had sent up a delegation to Los Angeles asking for assistance of some union organizers. I went down at that time, I think I was 18. They were lettuce workers. They were making 10 cents an hour. They were living in the most filthy conditions possible. The only drinking water they had, and this is under the hot sun of the Imperial Valley, and it gets awfully hot, the irrigation ditches going through the fields, which were also used for every other purpose of sanitation. Our demands were really very simple. The demand was for 15 cents an hour, for clean drinking water to be furnished to the workers in the fields, and for adequate sanitary facilities in the hovels where they were living, for recognition of the union. The strike was brutally assaulted by the vigilantes, the arm of the Associated Farmers. A number of us were arrested, and at that point I spent 6 months in jail, in the Imperial Valley Jail, on charges of vagrancy, inciting to riot, rout, and unlawful assembly.
This was your first time in jail?
No, I had been the first time I was arrested when I was 15 in a demonstration in Oakland in 1930, the unemployed demonstrations that ultimately led to unemployment insurance and WPA. I was arrested and sent to a juvenile detention home for 2 weeks at that point and then released.
Did your husband accompany you in this work?
No, he didn't.
You were by yourself then.
Yes, I was.
This was the period of John Steinbeck and his Grapes of Wrath. And how faithful was that book?
I think it was a pretty graphic and realistic description of the conditions. If anything, it underestimated the poverty, the despair, and the horror of the lives of these people. And as a matter of fact, John Steinbeck and Helen Gehagan Douglas, who organized the Committee to Aid Agricultural Workers, were of some assistance, not a great deal, in helping to focus attention, Steinbeck's book particularly, on this horrible area of our life. I should say to you, however, that skipping ahead many years, I have just recently looked at the conditions in the agricultural fields, examined again, and I must say that the conditions today are not very much better than they were in the 30s when we were organizing to get conditions. These people still represent the unwanted and the outcasts of our society.
They're still unorganized.
They're still unorganized. We did succeed in one thing, and that was the organizing of the canneries of California. As a matter of fact, I think I organized and got the first union contract of any cannery in California in 1937 or 38. My memory's a little hazy, at the California Sanitary Canning Company here in Los Angeles, which we organized in the CIO at that time. However, I should tell you, the conditions of union organizers at that point were very different from what you read about in the papers today. I remember that, for instance, when I was first a union organizer for the Trade Union Unity League, until the CIO was organized, we never received a salary. We, at the most, would get $5 or $10 a week to take care of our expenses, but it didn't occur to us or anyone else that we should be paid for doing something that we believed in. Then when I became a CIO organizer, we got a $40 paycheck from the CIO directly, And we used to split that paycheck and take only $20 in order to see that another organizer came on the payroll. And quite often we'd take that $20 in order to buy CIO pins and put out leaflets to explain conditions and so forth to the workers. So that the life of a union organizer in my youth was a very different one than what is described today.
What happened after the Imperial Valley?
Well, when I came out of jail, I went to San Pedro for about a year. While I was there, I was mainly concerned with the building of the Young Communist League. From there, I went to San Francisco.
Excuse me, is this the time when you first joined the Communists?
No, I joined the Young Communist League in 1928, in December 1st, 1928. But as I said, most of my activity was spent in organizing unions and not in the Young Communist League. In 1937, I first went to work for the CIO. Then in 1939, I took a civil service exam for deputy labor commissioner. The prerequisites for taking the exam was either 2 years as a practicing attorney or 4 years in labor relations, and I'd had many more than the 4 years in labor relations. I passed that civil service exam. As a matter of fact, I've been told that I was the first woman appointed a deputy labor commissioner in the state of California. I worked for the state of California as a deputy labor commissioner in San Francisco for 3 years until my son was born in 1943 and then returned to Los Angeles. A year and a half later, I went to work for the Mine, Mill, and Smelter Workers Union. All the men had gone into the service, and they were desperately in need of union organizers with experience. And then in 1945, I became a secretary for the Communist Party.
Now, let's go back a little bit. Why did you join the Young Communist League?
I joined the Young Communist League because I was convinced that it wasn't enough simply to view with horror the exploitation of man by man and the horrors that resulted from that, the injustice, the bigotry, the intolerance, the insecurity, the unemployment, that one had to get at the basic cause of why. And while I would say my first motivation was primarily emotional, simply a hatred of injustice and a hatred of oppression, I started the pursuit then of trying to understand what causes it. Is it simply that people are bad, that human nature is so vile that man can't stand man? Or is there a more basic reason that produces it? And I became convinced that the reason was the existence of an economic system that had within it all of these built-in characteristics that provided the horrors of society that I so detested. I might say that there's been nothing subsequently in my life that would change my opinion in regard to this as the basic reason for man's inhumanity to man.
I'd like to know now, somewhere along the way, did you divorce your first husband?
Yes. Mm-hmm. When I came back from, I came back from the Imperial Valley in 1934, but before I had gone to jail, I went to jail from May 1st to November 1st. I had to serve the full 6 months. I didn't get any time off for good behavior because I'd helped some juvenile prisoners that were in jail, and they found out that I was doing it. My husband and I most amicably agreed that we really wasn't working out as a marriage. We, I think, shared a mutual respect for one another, which we still have, but that it just wasn't a working marriage, and agreed that because I was going back to jail, he would get the divorce. It was much easier here in Los Angeles. I then got married again in 1940, and my second marriage, also a very fine human being, a man with whom I still have a great respect for, and, by the way, the father of my son, who is now 19 years old. We were married until 1947. I think, looking back, that the main reason for our ultimate divorce, he had been in the Army for many years. When he came home, again, we found the problem of finding mutual interests. Although, as I say, we were and remain very good friends. Again, it was an amicable agreement that both of us would, while remaining friends, would both be happier without marriage.
Describe him
a little bit. He's 6 feet two. Probably the handsomest of all the men I've known. A black Irishman. Matter of fact, it is his name, Healy, that I have kept as my public name as well as my private name.
And there's a third one?
Yes. Then in 1947, I married Slim Connolly, the former head of the state CIO in California and the head of the Los Angeles CIO and old-time newspaper man here in Los Angeles. Slim and I stayed married for 10 years, and again, I would say, a very amicable parting. With all three, it has remained a relationship of friendship without the desire for marriage.
So then at present, you're single again.
And planning to stay that way. Mm-hmm. I've done my duty to posterity.
How does the present period look to you? What do you see for yourself?
For myself?
In all this.
Oh, well, for myself, I see just a continuation of what I've always done, and that is, first of all, an insistence on my right to think as I please. I was arrested in 1951 under the Smith Act for alleged conspiracy to advocate the overthrow of the government by force and violence. Some 7 years later, the Department of Justice had to admit they had no evidence that could hold up in court to secure a conviction on this charge after the Supreme Court had insisted on higher standards of evidence. At that time, I refused to give in to the pressures that were quite enormous. I think that my feeling today is identical with what it has been all my life. I still feel as passionately and as vehemently that the injustice of man to man is something that people cannot sit by as observers and not want to do something about. I can't be a detached observer of these things and not want to do something. While my party has many weaknesses, and I could probably go into more detail on our weaknesses than the professional anti-communist, the fact remains that at this point there is no other organized alternative in our society that tries to provide a view of what to do about it. Well, in view of those circumstances, I propose to do exactly what I've been doing all the past of my life and to continue in it.
What has happened to your expectations that you had when you were 16 and started out on this idealistic course?
Well, first let me correct the term idealistic. It's not particularly idealistic because I am convinced that that ancient biblical question, am I my brother's keeper, can really only be answered by saying, I am my brother's keeper because otherwise I cannot keep myself. It is my own self-interests that have motivated me. I don't believe that I could find happiness nor security unless I seek at the same time to find my fellow man's happiness and security. And therefore, it hasn't been idealism. It has been self-interest that has motivated me, that I don't live on an island by myself, that all of mankind is involved in me, and I am involved in all of mankind. Well, since the years that I started, since I was, 14 actually, not 16, I've seen over a third of mankind choose the socialist solution for their futures. When I was a child, when I was 14 and started in this activity, it didn't appear that there would be anything beyond what was at that point considered only an experiment in the Soviet Union, and nobody could tell whether it would work or not work economically. Well, the answer of its economic working has, of course, been established by the fact that it is today the second industrial country in the world. But it has been joined by a whole number of socialist countries. Secondly, in my lifetime, the colonial peoples, who were so enormously enslaved to empires, have fought for and achieved a measure of at least political liberation, even though they may not have achieved economic emancipation. But this is a great big development. And third, even within my own country, well, first of all, unions that in my day were outcasts and pariahs, who were workers who went on strike, were shot down, clubbed, jailed. At least today, unions, no matter what else may be said, have a firm rooting in American life. They are established. A lot might be said about their inadequacies in fighting on behalf of their members, or their acceptance of the Cold War philosophy as their motivating factor for their demands. But nevertheless, they are there, and they weren't when I was young. I think that my generation and many communists helped to achieve this status of labor today, that without what we did in the 30s, and when we were beaten and clubbed and went to jail for it, and what millions of other Americans did for that same purpose, unions today would not be established as they are. And all this really establishes is that man achieves what he fights for. And because there in the 30s we fought, there was the achievement of unemployment insurance, which was considered absolutely ridiculous at that point. There was the achievement of the status of the right of workers to bargain collectively, and many of the social welfare concepts that have become quite acceptable at the point when I started in were considered Bolshevik plots. Today they are accepted truisms that must be fulfilled. I would suggest that many of the things that today appear to be simply impossible, such as public ownership of public utilities that everybody needs and depends on, like this telephone company that has this monopoly. Another few years we'll see more and more Americans taking for granted that, of course, the public should own something that all of the public has to use. I'm very excited by what I see, the potentials of what I see. A new generation, a young people coming along. They're not motivated by all the same things I was. They, for instance, are not as affected by the economic situation as my generation. They're more interested in questions of morality and of ethics. But they're a wonderful generation, and they're refusing to be cowed. They're refusing to live in an atmosphere of conformity. I think there's great promise for America.
You sound very hopeful and very optimistic. How does your son fit in to this? Is he going to follow your footsteps, do you think?
Oh, I doubt it. I think I've hoped always that my son will do what I think all human beings should do, and that's be true to their own psyche, to their own needs, their own temperament. My son had a very hard time as a youngster because of his mother's activity and the publicity and the arrests. But all in all, it has, I think, helped to develop into him into a very mature, a very intelligent young man who is most self-possessed and very well-adjusted. He goes to college. He won a scholarship. He always has known that if he was going to college, he'd have to find some way of doing it beside his mother's resources. And he is doing very well in school. He has a great intellectual excitement about questions. He insists on knowing for himself and thinking for himself. And beyond that, what could any mother ask?
This is almost like a religion, is it, to you?
No.
Your work?
No, because a religion is dependent upon a faith. A faith really in supernatural powers. My faith is based only on my feeling for my fellow man, that man is the most important thing in the world, and that man has the innate capacities to do the most beautiful and glorious things that could be asked for in society. But it lacks the religiosity because I know that my beliefs are not fixed in the sense of having a rigid dogma, that my beliefs only equip me for one thing, and that is to use a method of analysis of thinking that bases itself on what's the real world like, and therefore provides always for the changes in my thinking as the real world changes. If you're trying to compare the feeling of dedication to that of religious people, I don't think that's the property of just religion. I think that human beings who recognize that they aren't an island unto themselves, who recognize that their fate is bound up in societies, usually are willing to live lives that where the prerequisite is not what am I going to get out of it, what's in it for me, But what's in it for my fellow man? I've never had any desire to advance at the cost of my fellow man. I want to see my fellow man advance with me.
How do you compare your activities with other women's activities? Now, for example, some of the, just as an example, some of the peace groups that women are engaged in. How do you compare these with your work?
Well, I think what they're doing is very exciting and very, very important. I think for the first, I think that for most of them, it registers the first time that they have started to feel their responsibility to themselves and to their country for what is taking place as far as nuclear testing and the fight for peace is concerned. I think it's an enormously important and significant development, the spread and development of these women's peace activities. They are really answering the question of what is the role of women in society in a very important way as far as these activities. Matter of fact, they're going beyond that. You know, the Greeks used to define the term idiot as representing one who was not active in civic or political affairs. And they are proving that at least a large section of women refuse to be characterized and cataloged under the term of idiots by insisting on taking the fight for their destiny in their own hands. And I think it's quite natural, by the way, that women should be the leaders in this, because we who give birth to life are not going to allow others to take that life away, including the unborn generations yet to come. I think as they continue their activities, that they will start to widen out their own understanding, that they will start to do what I did, at least numbers of them will, to ask questions why, not simply to deal with the cause, the results of something, namely a foreign policy, but to want to know why do these things take place? Why do wars take place? And when they start to ask those questions, a good number of them, in my opinion, will start to deal then with the basic question of the capitalist system and of imperialism in this our country.
It always comes back to that.
Yes, it does. And that's, of course, it sounds grim, but it really isn't, because when you start dealing with basic causes, you're not easily distracted then by momentary things. For instance, I'm under the Attorney General has gone to the Subversive Activities Control Board and asked for an order for me to register under the McCarran Act. I'm not going to register under the McCarran Act because it would be a repudiation of all that I believe about my own activities as an American, loving my own country and being patriotic to my own country by fighting for what I think is in its best interests. But if I didn't have an understanding of why things take place, then every single event, every time a Negro is arrested, every time a Negro child can't go to a school where another goes, every time a new incident of brutality takes place, then I would simply be overwhelmed with despair at the totality of misery and corruption in our society. But because I do look for the basic cause of things, I, instead of being overwhelmed with the totality of misery and corruption, I see that which is bright and new and promising, and I therefore, I think, am able to maintain my own personal happiness and balance, as well as a political perspective.
What do you see in the future for yourself? You're going right down the same path?
I think so. I don't see anything, at least at this point. It's always risky to predict, but I see nothing that would in any way cause any great basic changes in my life. I can't imagine myself ever wanting to be detached from the activities I'm carrying on, critical as I may sometimes be of those activities and wanting them always to be better. But nevertheless, I would want to continue doing what I'm doing.
Someone else has said in another context that when you become aware of a problem, you also become responsible for it.
Yes, that's
true. For the solution of it.
That's a very fine saying.
And I have just been talking with Dorothy Healy, the chairman of the Communist Party for Southern California. Thank you very much.
Thank you.